Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peterson Toscano. Welcome to episode 25 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Saturday, June 23rd, 2018. Joining us in the Art House today is poet Tyree Day. As an African-American man living in the U.S. South, Tyree weaves together stories and voices from his family. He artistically expresses the collective trauma they have experienced and the deep insights they pass down. But first, I sit down with an African-American journalist. After 10 years of reporting on race, culture, and civil rights, Brenton Mock embraced environmental issues as his new beat. That was in 2008. He has since become a leading voice highlighting environmental racism in America. Brenton also speaks candidly about failures of predominantly white environmental organizations that attempt to reach out to people of color and what climate advocates can do to build a more diverse coalition. Brenton Mock writes for the Atlantic Monthly's City Lab team. Back in 2008, he was accepted for a fellowship at the Metcalf Institute at the University of Rhode Island. The goal was to train non-white journalists to cover the science of climate change.
I knew nothing about environmentalism. It just wasn't something I followed.
Like many science-based climate courses, the focus was not on U.S. cities, but up in the Arctic. He began to pursue his own research. He recognized that this issue, climate change, is very much about people and not just polar bears.
We very much did learn about declining polar bear populations and things of that order. But I stumbled upon the work of Dr. Robert Bullard, the father of environmental justice scholarship, and he spent the entire afternoon with me. And he told me, you know, this is not just about polar bears. This is really about everything that you've been seeing when you go to these black communities and you see black people suffering. Yeah, there's a real explanation for that.
Coming to this work, though, Brenton Mock had already spent a lifetime observing the impacts of segregation and racism. He witnessed firsthand how people of color experience pollution and the health risks associated with it.
Well, my sister, she has severe asthma, like really bad. And, you know, I remember when I was younger, we all lived under the same roof, having to wake up 2-3 o'clock in the morning because she was having an asthma attack, you know, them calling the ambulance and, you know, her being rushed to the hospital late at night, which was always terrifying. While that was terrifying, what is kind of interesting when I look back is how normal that was, like in the communities I grew up in, schools I went to, the churches I attended. When I was in grade school, I remember like every other kid had an inhaler. When I went to church, again, every other kid had an inhaler. And being outside playing on the playgrounds, you know, kids had inhalers, they were on all kinds of medication. It was enough that I didn't know that that was abnormal.
But in eighth grade, his parents placed Brenton in a predominantly white Catholic school.
This was probably the first time that most of the kids in my classroom did not have asthma, you know, where I was like, whoa, okay, so this is not like a normal thing. I mean, like the kids in that school, they were allergic to stuff like peanut butter and stuff. And I was just like, okay, I obviously can't go back and do the epidemiology. I don't know the diagnosis of every kid in my neighborhood, but I can tell you that, you know, I lived in a predominantly black community in the city. When you look at where asthma is most prevalent, it's most prevalent in cities affecting black communities, Latino communities disproportionately, and that has to be a byproduct of pollution in some way.
To get a clearer picture of how long-term and pervasive the pollution and health inequity is, I spoke with Dr. Natasha Dejanet. She is a policy analyst at the American Public Health Association. Her expertise is in environmental health. Dr. Dejanet explains that there has been a direct correlation between race and pollution.
in the early onset of the environmental justice movement, Dr. Robert Bullard published a paper that showed that the most common predictor of environmental toxins and where these toxins were located was race. Very unfortunately, African-American communities that are populated of African-American families are more likely to have higher pollution levels. Air pollution is certainly of concern, but water pollution is also of concern among African-American communities as well as communities of color. As I was doing some research on the topic, it was really disturbing to find that a lot of things that people were finding and the evidence that people were finding in the 80s and 90s, people are still finding today, very unfortunately.
Brenton Mock spoke about asthma in particular, both the ways his sister has suffered and the prevalence of asthma in the African-American communities he's moved in and out of. Dr. DeJohnette shared with me some of the studies about asthma.
One study found that African-Americans faced a 54% higher burden of air pollution compared to the overall population. When you looked at communities of color in general in this same study, it was still 28% higher, but it's even higher once they dug further into the African-American community. Also, African-American communities are more likely to live on the fence lines of pollution exposure. By fence lines, this could be close proximity to industrial polluters or traffic exposures or other point source polluters. The percent of African-Americans living in the fence lines of these communities is 75% greater than for the U.S. as a whole. Another study found that 3 times as many African-Americans compared to their Caucasian counterparts die from asthma. This statistic is even worse when we look at African-American children, where the ratio then becomes 5 to 1 African-American children compared to Caucasian children.
Speaking to Brenton Mock and Dr. DeJohnette, I found myself remembering my own childhood. For the first 6 years of my life, I lived in Stamford, Connecticut, in the USA. We were an Italian-American, working-class family living on the outskirts of the industrial zone of the city. In fact, my father walked 2 blocks to his job at a plastic product manufacturer. We would joke about the terrible smell. I recently dug up my kindergarten class photo. While most of our immediate neighbors were white, every person in the photo is black, except for the teacher and me. As a kid, I suffered from severe asthma. One of my very first memories is of being rushed out of the house in the middle of the night and placed in a plastic oxygen tent. I felt terror at not being able to breathe. I felt alone. Back then, parents were not allowed to spend too much time in hospital with a sick child. When I was 6, my mom, my sisters, and I spent a summer with my grandparents who recently moved out of New York City to the Catskills in upstate New York. Within a week, my asthma attacks stopped. I was able to run around and play without collapsing. Seeing this dramatic improvement to my health, my parents decided we needed to leave the city and move into the country. We relocated to this rural community that welcomed us. I found new friends, and my dad got a job as a welder. I also never again suffered from an asthma attack. In fact, by the time I was 13 years old, I rarely ever felt symptoms return. I was an asthma refugee. My circumstances provided me a way to leave the cause of my illness. I told Brenton this story, who in turn talked about mobility.
You know, you mentioned the mobility of you living in Stamford and then, but having the ability to move to the Catskills. Well, most black people didn't have that. You know, they lived in an area designated as undesirable because of its proximity to pollution or because of its proximity to vulnerability to a disaster. And they may have wanted to move, but they couldn't, right? They didn't have the resources. They didn't have the money. They may have had family ties that were so close such that they could not move. So when you're stuck in place, and it's a place where, let's be honest, so I mean, where Black people live is normally not where they have chosen to live in the first place. It is the place where they have been designated to live because no other neighborhood would take them in. Most of the 20th century, when restrictive housing covenants and Jim Crow and redlining, forbade African Americans from living in certain neighborhoods. Even once those walls have been broken down of redlining and Jim Crow and all of that, a Black family still won't move into a predominantly white neighborhood because of that legacy. They know that there was racial terror happening when other African Americans try to integrate.
So what does this mean in regards to climate change?
Climate change literally is overheating segregation. It's taking the impacts of segregation and it's overheating it. It's adding additional vulnerability to that place. It's adding additional risk, additional threats, additional opportunities for people in that neighborhood to lose their lives or to have their lives compromised. The legacy of racial segregation in America has made it such that African Americans, all people of color, have been forced to live in the most undesirable areas of any place in America. I mean, no matter where you go, and not just because of the living conditions, right? But because of literally where it is located. It's in a flood zone. It's in an area where there's probably zoning for industrial practices not far away, or it's close to power plants. It's close to waste disposal, waste incinerators. I mean, no matter where you go, this is the case, still the case today.
Brenton explains that a problem this big requires a giant response.
Let's face it. I mean, the way that politics happens in Congress, you really need a groundswell of people to move Congress members on these kinds of things. And you can't do it if it's just your little Sierra Club chapter in one little part of the city. I mean, you really have to bring all people into this, right? You can't move it with just a few people.
That means predominantly white, mainstream environmental groups need to partner with people of color. Brenton believes it requires embracing a larger, more inclusive agenda.
It's incumbent upon those people to really make connections with people from other communities, from Black communities, Latino communities, queer communities, communities for which saving the earth is not at the center of their worldview because they have to deal with all this other stuff like police violence and racism and homophobia and sexism. We have so many other things that we have to think about. Saving the earth is not always at the top. It's there, but it's not always at the top of the things we have to deal with because it's not one of the most immediate and urgent threats to us. But it's incumbent upon whoever is thinking at this, at the climate, at as a center of their worldview, to bring all of those people in. And to do that, it's not just a matter of you convincing these people, look, we need you to sign on this climate agenda that we have. You have to become part of their agenda. You have to be concerned about police violence and gun violence against African Americans. You have to be concerned and act on behalf of, step in front of, immigrants who are facing deportation. You have to be concerned about hate crimes, homophobic hate crimes. You have to be concerned about Me Too and sexual violence and sexual harassment. It can't be an isolated kind of myopic thing of like, you know what? Climate change is going to kill all of us if y'all don't get on with our agenda. If I'm Black, I'm like, well, we already dying. So what do we care? I've lost family members to all kinds of police, and climate change is going to take out the earth in what, 100 years? My community was just decimated by mass incarceration in the last 20 years. So those are the kinds of conversations and interconnections that have to be made.
In working with other white climate advocates, I see the sincere desire to make the world a better place for everyone. They explain how by taking on climate change, we will also reduce localized pollution and decrease the health risks. I hear frustration and confusion from some of these climate advocates. In talking about climate solutions, they ask people of color, don't you understand? We're doing this for you too.
If you're a Black person in the audience and you're hearing this white climate hawk saying, look, I am trying to do this for you and for the good of all people, You know how many times I've heard that? When a politician is running for office, he comes to me and he says, look, I'm going to bring Amazon headquarters to your neighborhood, and I'm doing this for you. I'm doing this for the good of all people. You've heard the developer come into your neighborhood and say, look, we're going to build these condos, and we're doing it for you. We're doing it for the good of the community. There's always somebody who's coming into the black community or to black people or Hispanic people and telling them, you need to believe in this agenda because it's good and it will help. It will lift all boats. It will lift all sails. It will help all people. We hear it just all the time. You don't sound any different. And very rarely do you have any of these people coming into the community and saying, okay, what are your immediate needs? What's a day like for you? How can we actually solve some of the problems that you deal with on a daily basis and then try to build a symbiotic relationship?
I asked Brenton about one idea being floated by some climate advocates, carbon fee and dividend.
You know, you bring up carbon fee and dividend. I like that. I like it a lot, which could be promising. But again, I mean, it would take a lot of really fine tuning that to make sure that there was actual equity in the way that tax revenue would be collected and distributed back to the people.
As we winded up the interview, Brenton grew reflective about the past 10 years covering climate change. Brenton has shifted his focus to consider the roles cities can play in taking on climate change and justice.
They are the laboratories that are turning out solutions for climate change. We can't look to the White House. We cannot look to Congress. We can't look to the governors in most states. So we really need to be looking at cities and see what kinds of solutions, climate solutions, environmental solutions, transportation solutions, housing solutions, criminal justice solutions. We write about all of that at citylab.com, and those are the kinds of ideas that really need to circulate and get out further.
Brenton Mock and the other journalists at CityLab are dedicated to the people who are creating the cities of the future and those who want to live there. In our show notes, we have links for you to dig deeper into pollution inequity and other topics that have come up. Visit Citizens Climate Radio over at soundcloud.com or find us at citizensclimatelobby.org/blog. Now, it is time for the Art House.
If you're like paying attention to the world, that's what artists do. Like, if you're looking at the world and like you have empathy and vulnerability and you're looking at the world and you're actually really paying attention to the world, how could you not write about the world, you know, and about things that's going on? Like, how could they not affect your work?
That's poet Tyree Day from North Carolina in the USA. Tyree won America Poetry Review's Honickman First Book Prize. His poetry collection, River Hymns, contains fragments from his childhood, superstitions passed down, and visitations from the dead. I was also struck with how closely the book is grounded in the natural world. Tyree is going to read some of his poems for us. He recognizes not everyone spends time with poetry.
I teach at St. Augustine's University here in Raleigh. And we have early college students in there, you know, so they're still in high school. I'll bring all my books. I have a bunch of book of poems. I bring them around. They'll tell me, like, yeah, we don't really read poetry. That's not something that's given to them. Well, who knows, you know, maybe it's given to them and they don't read it. It's really like introducing them to like a new language, you know, to think about language in a new way.
Some of the poems Tyree will explain, others he will just read. You may hear two curious sounds in the background. One is the rustling of the pages of his book and other papers. The other is a chirp sound, like the cricket that comes up so often in his River Hymns poems. The sound is actually the short beep of a smoke alarm ready for a new battery. I asked Tyree about his poem, Tamed, a very personal and vulnerable poem.
I think I'm just now making this connection right now. It is one of the only poems where the speaker is like truly looking at themselves. And it's like the lightest tone, you know? It's like literally, this is gonna sound savvy, but it's like the tone of a butterfly. Like, if you thought of a butterfly, it would be tame. When Terrence Hayes picked this poem to be in the New York Times, I was like so shocked. But I'm like slowly starting to see like how it works in the book and how it works on its own. And I think it is like it's a moment where the speaker's really looking at themselves, but in this like still this very like young boyhood, the world hasn't like destroyed them yet. Even the way they think about death in this book, like these crickets die in this book. In any other poem, if something died, the speaker would have gone off and explored it, but it just is very lightly brushed over. Anyways, Tamed. I was the unbroken horse of that town, slept standing up, held on to the breeze like wildflowers. I kept caterpillars in jars. My mama let them go. I figured they just disappeared. There are moments you can hear God say things, soft-spoken, the sun settling between thin ponds. Collected crickets in 2-liter bottles, dropped them in a path far from the house, one or two at the bottom drowning in the last wig of cola, the smell of mama's leaf pile faint and almost gone. My mama would say, to kill a cricket is a sin against the night.
Tyree Day's poem, Is It Love?, references a different type of vulnerability, one of place. In talking about the poem, the topic of extreme weather events and sudden displacement came up.
Usually with the storm, you know, and it's the person who owns that building, if they don't decide to rebuild or like do anything with the property, right? Those people, like, they lose their home. And this home, like, the in some cases this home that generations have lived out of, you know what I mean? Is it love? I was made to wrestle a cousin in the middle of the living room. The small brown floor sofa and chairs pushed against the wall. 2 older cousins over us, drunk. The television must have been broken, or someone asked if there was a fight on, then one of them looked at us. I'm in the same house my grandmother died in. We don't own this house, never will. Our landlord, white and old, comes over smiling. I wonder where he lives, while my mother curses him, gets him in, out. We own kerosene heaters, the dust on our faces, as we try to prove something we couldn't tie down to the floor. Throw love at the wall, see if it hollers.
Though it doesn't appear until page 40, Remember Birds is one of the first poems Tyree wrote for the collection.
Remember Birds. We were never allowed to say lucky. Who needs a genie when you have God? When the water rises, all the birds disappear. We prepare our homes for the flood the way a preacher prepares a body, hands at your side or over your chest. Everyone gathered somewhere to pray. No one questions who God will take. Someone is always taken. Remember, cardinals are good luck, but never touch a lone red feather being held by grass blades. My mama used to say, boy, you better make sure they make me look good for the Lord.
In a poem with a numbered list of stanzas, Tyree gives voice to his mother.
When my mother had the world on her mind, crickets in her ear. 1. Boy, don't let a shadow in you. I never want to see the devil in your eyes, a traceable line of your daddy's. 2. If you dream about fish or river, somebody's pregnant, we need the water more than it needs us. 3. Dream about snakes, you haven't been living right, wash your hands of it. 4. They are shooting boys who look like you. You know my number, use it, keep all your blood. 5. Stay. 6. Alive. Thank you.
Since publishing River Hymns, Tyree Day has been exploring issues of mobility and race. Like Brenton Mock discussed earlier in the program, Tyree also points out the challenges of traveling as an African-American man. Tyree told me about the Green Book. Starting back in the 1930s, the Green Book served as a guide for black travelers. It listed where they could safely get a meal, fill up the gas tank, and find a place to stay. The Green Book has been revisited recently and also serves as an inspiration for Tyree's newest poems.
Field notes on leaving. There'll be a day sometime in the near future when this guide will not have to be published. Green Book, 1949. The North Star is irrelevant, miles and miles above my head. I do not want the constellations any nearer. I know there are whole cities all over this country that are so bright you can't see the stars, the sky no wider than the heart is wide. The night President Obama was elected, we danced in the street of our small university to "My President is Black." My first time on my own, I felt like I had a father. Every one of us was flying. A blunt passed around, I got lifted. My heart to lift and all the world explore. If there were stars, I did not see them. We've never been through airport security without being pulled to the side and searched. To know you can die anywhere doesn't feel like flying. I can't go to Canada and leave my mama here alone. I brought my southern drawl to New York, unchained myself from my uncle's grave. I explained all I could see from where I stood, and here I am. I called my dad to Harlem, looked to the starless, prayed they come. If you see me dancing, I'm sending a code. Someone is escaping. I can't afford to think like Whitman, that whoever I shall meet on the road, I shall love, and whoever beholds me shall love me. Doing the Dougie, trying to find the ocean, looking everywhere.
When doing public readings of his collection of poetry, River Hymns, Tyree ends with the last poem in the collection.
Say river, sea river. I threw up the river last night. Trout already gutted. Salamanders rocking between the books on my bedroom floor. Then the river stood up. Bow-legged it walked like it was drunk, like it was an uncle. So I followed the dizzy river into my mother's backyard, watched it fall and flood the houses, pick itself up, laugh it off. We splashed past where the men slept on the ground, their low eyes always where they laid at night. I wondered if they counted the stars together until it turned into a Lightning Hopkins song. 21, 22, my black dog blues. If they played spades with planets, toasted a wild Irish rose to the seven sisters. The river took me to the big graveyard. We didn't cut through, funneled around, ran a damp finger along the fence. The river would catch a name as we passed the straight stones, and every so often say one. Phillips, Jones, the dead heard the wet voice and started calling back, river.
I urge you to get your own copy of Tyree Day's collection of poetry, River Hymns. It is published by the American Poetry Review. Also check out his website, Tyree.work. Tyree is spelled T-Y-R-E-E, Tyree.work. Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Radio. Citizens Climate Radio is written and produced by me, Peter Santoscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Winchester, Allison Cabisco, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. Special thanks to my guest, Brenton Mock, Dr. Natasha DeJeanette, and Tyree Day. Also thanks to Bloomberg University and Mondrigal Books in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.